Minister, Minister Pravin and the DG, together with the rest of the senior executive management of Treasury, honorable members, and also acknowledge provincial chairs of finance committees from provinces. Almost all provinces are represented here, Minister, and chairpersons here, chair of the finance in the NA, and of the appropriations in the NA, and all of them here. I think the objective of our meeting today, or the purpose of our meeting, is to give over to the Minister and the team to do the overview of the budget as was presented yesterday. And once more, Minister, we want to join the rest of South Africans and congratulating you for a well-crafted budget that you presented. Of course, that is yet to be debated and shape the course of transformation in our country. Thanks very much. Can we welcome the Minister, and the Minister can lead us in the briefing.
Good morning, chairpersons. Very privileged to have so many chairpersons in attendance this morning. And members of the committees that are represented here, and welcome to our provincial delegates as well. Just a few introductory remarks, and then I'll hand over to the Director General. He's done a little bit less work than I have recently, so he can carry the burden a bit. And he's younger as well, so it helps. I mean, you've heard the speech, you've read the material, so there's no point in repeating all of the details. Safe to say that this budget is, on the one hand, about the manner in which we are still approaching the question of fiscal consolidation and trying to maintain our commitment to the consolidation path, recognizing that that involves three things. One is living within the expenditure ceiling. The second, regrettably, the raising of taxes to the tune of 28 billion rands. And thirdly, making sure that we manage and taper the debt levels in respect of the debt to GDP ratio. The second big issue is, Chairperson, the question of inclusive growth. And South Africans, but also other interested parties and stakeholders, will constantly ask us the question, what is your growth path? What is your growth plan? Because without a viable growth strategy for South Africa, which is reflected in the numbers at the end of the day, we won't have the revenue that growth generates, nor the jobs that growth generates, nor the inclusivity that potentially growth generates as well, if we do things right, in order to meet the national requirements that we have. The third point, which will be the sort of second slide that the DG will look into for you, is a reflection on the South African realities as far as the majority of the population is concerned. The data in the speech that we shared yesterday comes from a three-year research program that Treasury initiated, I think in 2014 or 2013, called Ready 3x3, but it was to explore what does inclusive growth mean and how does it relate to the socioeconomic and economic realities in South Africa. So, for example, if we say that 90%, 95% of the wealth in South Africa is in the hands of 10% of the population, then that's a huge level of inequality and disparity. And you might be already aware of the fact that there are similar issues being raised in the rest of the world, which I pointed out yesterday as well. And in fact, the narrative since probably the latter quarter of last year globally has changed quite substantially. So the issues of inequality, poverty, the gap between the top 10% and the rest of the population are issues that impact both in developed and developing countries. But equally importantly, those sorts of disparities reflect themselves in the politics of both the country where these disparities exist, but also globally as well. So today, more so than ever before, we should actually be talking about the political economy of the different situations in which we find ourselves in, because there's this connection between economic status, if you like, and dynamics on the one hand, and the politics of the day. And the politics of the day, as you can see in certainly in the Western part of the world, has a key influence over economic policy choices that countries are making. So that dynamic, chairpersons, is something that our parliament should also concern itself with and how it impacts upon our own situation. That then leads to the next point, which is the necessity for transformation or radical transformation of our own situation. And we should find some basis upon which to agree that this disparity between the 10% and the 90%, the continued reinforcement of inequality, the maldistribution of wealth in South Africa, the fact that we still have a serious problem of intergenerational poverty, in other words, we're not breaking the poverty cycle, the lack of accumulation of assets and wealth and prosperity in the hands of the lower middle class, and that's one of the results from the study as well, that there's a so-called missing middle, 60,000-70,000 family income to about 300,000-400,000 family income, is completely stuck in terms of prosperity filtering down to them. And that's an issue that across party lines we should be concerned about and find some consensus on what transformation actually means in the lives of these people. The last point is that there's a connection between growth and transformation. If the growth engine doesn't kick in, transformation becomes a lot more difficult. But the word transformation has a much wider meaning, as we say in the speech. That transformation must mean, in the context of these numbers and the reality in South Africa, that changes to our economy and to both its inner dynamics and ownership patterns must mean a change in the lives of the vast majority of South Africans, the 55 million people, not just an improvement in the lives of a select few. It must mean that we must choose a new, if you like, economic model, which would suggest a different approach to restructuring our economy. Because there are new dynamics at play, new technologies that are coming to the fore, artificial intelligence that is going to impact upon the way jobs are conceived into the future. And it's better for us to start anticipating those, because they'll certainly begin to impact upon our own economy, and some of it is already happening, robots in factories, and more of it is going to come. So what does a job mean 10 years from now? How will people earn an income, let alone the fact that we have high levels of unemployment in South Africa at the moment? It must also, transformation must also mean and give some guidance on how do we deconcentrate a very concentrated economy, which is part of the legacy that we've inherited from our past. Because concentration means price dominance, concentration means no competition of any significant order. Concentration also means difficulty in terms of breaking barriers to entry in different industries as well. And that means we have a less efficient economy at the end of the day. So what does deconcentration mean? Are competition laws adequate and competition policy adequate for the kind of historical task that we face? Or does it actually go beyond that as well? And the bottom line, ultimately, as you see in this slide, is that the low growth trap that we're finding ourselves in is not going to be helpful in any of the senses that we require growth to be helpful at this point in time. So we'll take you through the details and then avail ourselves to any questions that you might have. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Minister. DG can proceed.
Thank you very much, Chairpersons.
honorable members and minister. The next slide, number three, summarizes it. It was key theme in the minister's speech. It runs through the budget, which is that there is no contradiction between transformation and economic growth. In fact, it may well be that if we transform in fundamental ways, as the minister articulated, that could spur growth. And if, of course, we were to focus on just growing without transforming, that too would not be sustainable. So transformation must be broad-based, and indeed, to achieve that, we must it must mobilize investment, create jobs, and empower South Africans or South African citizens to be able to do things for themselves, to participate in the economy in as meaningful a way as possible, and indeed they must be able to accumulate assets, accumulate wealth, and improve their livelihoods, as we had indicated. Now, on the next slide, we talk, we list a number of things that are required to achieve inclusive growth. If you look at the sub-bullets under the third bullet there, we talk to the issues of the transformation of patterns of asset ownership, production, and competition, as the minister was alluding, but also the complementarities between private sector and public sector, which would synergize and ensure that we achieve much higher rates of growth than we have seen so far. Of course, providing workers and the poor with access to markets and social and economic infrastructure. So all of those things, we believe, would actually set us on the path to achieving higher growth, mass-based participation in the mainstream economy, and of course, make a fundamental change in ownership patterns, in the quality of life of South Africans. And the next slide, a very familiar slide, slide number five, just when we think about crafting a fiscal framework, we always have to reflect on what the global economy is likely to look like for the period that we will be crafting the budget for. And assess what that will mean for the South African economy. Of course, as the budget review and the minister's speech of yesterday indicated, it would seem that the world economy, so to speak, it's on a path of recovering, but there is a lot of uncertainty in the environment, characterized or manifesting itself in sort of inward-looking, you can say, extremely protectionist policies. Some of them we are yet to know how they will impact on the global economy and on South Africa's growth prospects. But we hope that the prospects will still be good enough for us to realize the growth focus that we set out on the next slide. Now, I've touched on the issue of global uncertainty. The next slide quite briefly just shows over a period of time an index of commodity export prices. And it just shows, you know, that the peaks and troughs, and the fact that we have had in recent times, go back to the 70s, very strong growth in that index,
and South Africa benefited quite massively from that. Of course, the index comes down, and then the recent boom that we saw, and followed by some tanking. But of course, the point we make in the budget review and the minister's speech is that the commodity prices do seem to be on some path to recover. That's partly why our focus are what they are. Now, on South Africa's economic focus, on slide 7, we anticipate that growth will improve, albeit moderately so, supported by the real depreciation in the currency, which we expect would support the competitiveness of South African exports. I've touched on the issue of commodity prices already. The drought appears to be behind us. We would hope that the fall armyworms don't replace it in one form or another. The electricity situation has stabilized. Our base forecast assumes that that situation is going to stay the same. And of course, in the budget review, we also show a chart which shows the number of person hours lost, which has fallen considerably in the last 2 years. And we assume that that will continue. Those things put together get us to come to the forecast for growth that you see in the towards the bottom of the table, 1.3 in 2017, rising to about 2.2 by the third year of the forecast period. Of course, we always want to draw the attention of honourable members to the fact that we make this variation of a calendar year when we talk this forecast versus the fiscal year. The difference is quite material because they overlap, I think, only by two quarters. Because you drop one, and you pick another one, and all of a sudden they can produce quite a different thing. Anyway, so on the next slide, perhaps the most important point to make on that slide is just look at those red bars where real growth in fixed investment contracted. The two parts you see, 90s and late 2000s, you would see that each originated from an external, you can call it shock of one sort or another, spilling over into the gross fixed investment trend in South Africa. We don't know of any external, call it factor, shock, of consequence, like those two, which explains the dip in 2016, which calls for deep reflection, sort of necessitates that we should pause and ask ourselves, you know, could it be that this is a manifestation more of domestic factors, conditions, and if so, what are those? And you would see, again, summarized in the budget review chapter 1, things that we do think that if they were to be, call it resolved, concluded, insofar as their policy development, we do think that they would unleash the potential of the economy. On slide 9, we show data for the key sectors of the economy and how the sectors have performed over time. You'll see that gross value or real value added in agriculture fell over the last 2 years, understandable because of the drought, mining, and we sort of connect the mining one to safety, stoppages, commodity prices, and rise in costs in that period. And of course, you can see that the services, the real estate, finance, insurance services sector has remained, you can call it the mainstay of the economy. On the budget proposals, I don't want to bore you too much about them because you heard about them, and I saw many people commenting on them. But the expenditure, the expenditure side, revised it for 2017-18 down by 10 billion. We had the government had made the commitment as far back as February last year in relation to this, and indicated that additional taxes would be necessary. Details of those to the extent or to the tune of 28 billion, and details of those were set out in Chapter 4 of the budget review, and indeed were covered quite extensively in the minister's speech yesterday. Quite importantly, in our view, the budget deficit in 2017 will be 3.1%. If you look over the medium term, the government has been able to demonstrate, notwithstanding the sort of slowing down in growth or deceleration, if I may call it that, in growth, the material gap in revenue and the downward revisions that carry through in future years, government has been able to still stick firmly on the path of fiscal consolidation. Marginal slippage, maximum 0.2% of GDP. We think that that's not something material, consequential enough to write home about it. Of course, where we will end in each one of those future years, as both the budget review and the minister's speech signaled very strongly, is going to depend on what happens to growth and what happens to revenues correspondingly. Net debt will stabilize over this period, and I'll get to a table just now that shows the switch in the primary balance from a deficit to a surplus, which technically just by is it just my ears? Oh, there's
sorry, DJ, I think there's a technician tampering with his sound and vision.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, that, let me
we
continue. First I heard the sound without seeing what was happening, so I was about to run out. I only come from Kanduli after all. So I'm saying the debt will stabilize. Now, quite often, questions get asked about this. People say you had set a target of 46-48%. There is never a target of tax to GDP that's set. We just state what the consequential change in this ratio is after a whole lot of things that government can influence or decide on, this turns out to be. Now, this is not meant to suggest that it is not an indicator we don't care about. But it's just to say, sometimes too quickly, if there was a number and we say, now we think that will stabilize around this, then people say, last time you said, and this time you've missed the target, not quite, which is not quite the case. We would have preferred that that ratio shouldn't perhaps touch or exceed 50, but there it is. The most important indicator, in our humble opinion, is the primary balance that I'll get to, and whether debt stabilizes, in other words, ceases to be on the rise as a proportion of GDP, because that is the real measure that do you does the country have a handle, an ability to limit the extent to which debt runs away, and we think we are actually as a country. Wage bill has stabilized. Of course, we've got to bear in mind and be frank with ourselves, we are in the last, or shall I say, next financial year, we will enter the last year of the current wage agreement. So there is only 1 year for which there is a wage agreement applicable for the next 3 year MTS. The two outer years are based on assumptions. This normally gets us into trouble. Yesterday, I was somewhere to collect a memorandum, and the people were saying, you know, Treasury fixes this thing. It's not fixed. But we have to have a budget that makes sense, which must make some assumption about what wage bill growth is likely to be, understanding that the outcome will be determined by the wage agreement. Some procurement reforms have been made, and state-owned companies are a risk. The minister spoke to the need to inject some capital in some of them over time. If we have chosen to have them, then they must be going concerns. You can't have them and then leave them dithering on the brink of not being going concerns. Our budget is redistributive. Both, I could even say that it's and progressive. I hope I'm not abusing the meaning of the word. If you look at our taxes, those who earn a lot more or earn more pay proportionally more in taxes versus those who earn less or little, on the one hand. And in terms of benefits, the benefits of public expenditures tend to accrue largely to the lower income groups. And the chart that's on slide 11 shows just that. If you go, perhaps you read that chart from the right, extreme right, you would see that the top 10% of the households receive, insofar as the social spending, they receive 6% benefit to the tune of 6%, whereas they contribute 72% in taxes. If you jump to the extreme left, look at the bottom 50%, you get a reversal of that. That makes the budget to be redistributive. We'll show it further when we look at the next slide with the chart at the bottom, which just show the per capita allocations to provinces. You will see that what you would call broadly speaking, poor provinces tend to get proportionally more, both in the form of the equitable share per capita and in the form of conditional grants. Take Northern Cape, sparsely populated, generally poor. Then you see the bar standing taller than all of them. It's not measuring the land area, which is another advantage they have. Also, then juxtapose that against Gauteng, which accounts for about 35%, I think, of GDP, but in terms of what Gauteng receives, in per capita allocations, both equitable share and of course, if you were to look deeper into the stats on the income or economic profiles of households, individuals, you would see that indeed this is redistributive. But again, because ruralness and poverty tends to overlap. If you look on the at the graph on the bottom right-hand side, you would see that most of the rural municipalities are the biggest beneficiaries of the redistributive character of our resource allocation processes, whereas the metros, where the wealth is generated, the bulk of the economic activity takes place, are on the left-hand side. We if we flip to the next slide, a matter that was spoken about at length in the minister's speech, the tax shortfall. Honorable members would recall, it was 23 in October estimated. We now have revised that estimate upwards to 30.4 billion. Largely, it's PIT, which historically had tended to help support tax collection. It had been more buoyant until now. VAT, largely because of a fall in imports, customs, and you can see, then corporate income tax has offset some of that. So we then get to 14, which is the consolidated fiscal framework. The way to perhaps look at this is first just look at 2017-18, the column, because that is the year with the aggregates, some of which are in the Division of Revenue Bill, which the committees will be considering, in the Appropriation Bill, again, which is going to be law. So those aggregates are material and important in that respect. Revenue, 1.4 trillion. Expenditure, 1.563 trillion. And non-interest expenditure, 1.4 trillion. And you can see that debt service cost, it's 169. And it, perhaps it's more important to call this debt service cost, not interest payment. I mean, just because over that period, there are also redemptions, just to bear in mind. Sorry about that. And of course, the budget balance, 149, translating to 3.1% in percentage terms, and the primary balance, positive, 0.4. That's where I was talking about that switch. In fact, it occurs this year, the switch, on a consolidated basis, which then gives you that stabilization I was talking about. Of course, then if you want to see trends, are things improving over time? You can start at the bottom and just see that the primary balance will be decidedly positive at 60 billion or 1.1% of GDP by the last year, and the budget balance minus 2.6. So we are on course. We are on course to achieve our fiscal objectives as we had set them out last year in October. Not that there is any material deviation from that, from what we had said in February, save for what I'm referring to in relation to taxes. 15, slide 15, is just, I can really say it's a graphical representation of what I've just talked to, especially the difference between revenue and non interest expenditure, and again, 16 shows the stabilization of debt, but then we show both gross, which is where we just look at debt without taking into account the fact that we've got cash balances, but also net, which is saying now, taking into account that we've got cash balances because we know them, they are there in the bank, and those will be your foreign or your sterilization deposits and whatever other cash is in the system. the proposals, I know that honorable members have scrutinized this part. I won't waste your time. I know that people have worked out now how much tax they will pay this time around. So I don't have to bore you with it. But on a very, very serious note, there is very limited adjustment for bracket creep this time around again. Full adjustment would have amounted to, I think, some 14 billion. We have done a partial adjustment, just giving back 2 billion, 2.5, held back 12 billion or thereabout. First adjustment. So we were working last night, and you can see the effects of it. Someone said to me, 16 billion from just 100,000 people, because they had missed, because they had the 45% new bracket. They thought that all of the 16 billion would come from there. I said, look, no chance. The biggest proportion of it still comes from the people where the emphasis has been very little, by the way. Life is very strange in that regard, because 14 billion, 12, am I right? No, yeah, sorry, 12.1. The biggest adjustment is coming from, in terms of the contribution to the PIT take, from the partial adjustment for fiscal drag, whereas the bracket is going to yield 4.4 billion. The new bracket, and then it's the dividend withholding tax, which is introduced just to make sure that we retain the horizontal equity of the tax system. You pay your fair share regardless of how you receive your income. That is it. And of course, then bits in the general fuel levy, which we are exceedingly mindful can be viewed as being regressive, and of course then the tax on cigarettes and alcohol, I suspect, will be sobering to those who indulge in those two items. We show then a pie chart which people the House is familiar with, insofar as where the money goes. Education still stands out, basic education, and when you combine it with post-school education, then you realize that indeed the government is putting the money where its priorities are: education, and of course you can see where health is, social protection, economic affairs, which is very important insofar as future growth is concerned. Of course, that black part of the chart, which is debt service costs, appropriately named here, is the area that we want to keep as small as possible. But it's not very easy to control, because once you have taken debt, that part just takes care of itself from a certain point. On the next slide, we show the growth rates, which just says what we all know. I won't waste your time. Debt service costs being the fastest rising, the next one being post-school education and training. That one is good. Of course, we, as the minister said in his speech and in the interviews he conducted, we need to maintain a reasonable balance in the proportional, if I may call it that, funding levels, rates of growth across the entire system. Putting too much resources perhaps in higher education, if it means at the expense of the lower levels, it may just not be consistent with everything that that we want to do. In fact, there is research to show that returns, both private and social, to education are higher at the lower levels than at the higher levels. In fact, at the higher levels, private returns are very high to an individual than society. But I won't bore you with with that stuff. Some of the budget allocations, I will not repeat them with your permission. There may be a couple of those, by the way, that we need to correct. Doing things in a big rush towards the end, there were one or two numbers that we got wrong. Some of them are over 3 years, but we said 1 year, and others, but we apologize for that. Then we get to where the public sector infrastructure investment has been going. The slide is 21, and you, honorable members, will see, you know, over the years there has been firm growth, strong growth in investment. State-owned entities playing a very important part for almost all the time, but of course there is now sort of leveling off of that. There have been changes in the procurement area to try and achieve the savings that the minister had challenged the chief procurement office to achieve. Those we summarize in slide 22. There is a gazette that the minister signed, which was published on the 20th of January. It will take effect on the 1st of April when the new financial year begins. It does a number of things which give preference to designated groups, preference to locally produced goods, goods with high local content, and makes adjustments to the to a number of thresholds. The main purpose is to use procurement smartly to achieve other socio-economic and development objectives without compromising the other objectives insofar as the policies in the different sectors are concerned. On slide 23, we talk to the establishment of the NHA Fund. The Department of Health is hard at work, very hard at work, to set up the administrative mechanisms, protocols that would pertain to this. And as soon as that work is concluded, hopefully before October, if that is the case, then when we get to the adjustment, it would be possible to do something to make sure that the fund is not an empty shell, as the minister's speech indicated yesterday. And of course, over the long term, as it, there was signaling, there may be different mechanisms to fund that. And of course, this is going to go to prioritizing very valuable programs like giving hearing aids to learners, spectacles, which will go a long way to enhance their ability to learn effectively, get the maximum benefit from the resources that government is channeling towards that area. We are working with the Department of Economic Development and the PICC on a new budgeting facility for infrastructure projects. The idea here is to make sure that large infrastructure projects that normally have cash outlays over longer periods than the ones for which we currently have our rolling budget frameworks, we can have a more transparent, more comprehensive approach to this, where when we, in the first instance, have a strongly rigorous process for evaluating projects technically. For a particular problem, find or identify the best solution out of a continuum of possible solutions to it. If it's a transport problem, do we need to build airports between the two points, a speed train, road, multiple carriage road, all of that kind of stuff, down to determining whether it could be best delivered as a public-private partnership or just a project to be funded directly from the fiscus. Once all of those bits are decided, then have a very transparent way where when we approach Parliament, we set out what is the full commitment fiscally that we're getting the system into, so that it's not piecemeal. We show you a little bit in the education system that I went through. We had the story of a camel which negotiated with its owner, it personified, and it sort of asked that it just put its head in and then said, look, it's in the neck. And before the owner realized, the camel was inside and the owner was outside. We don't want to apply that to you and South Africans. That is on 14. Now, on the next slide, we just summarize very quickly the range of public sector institutions that have got various mandates, and we talk to the public sector borrowing requirement, which will be now 254 or 5.8% of GDP. We also talk to the state-owned companies' projected borrowing, which is usually very valuable borrowing, because a lot of it goes towards infrastructure, not all, but a lot of it. And of course, we make reference to the DFIs. The minister spoke about the state-owned companies, and I know that honourable members had all of that, and I referred to the capital injection into SAA, which is under discussion and possibility for the post office. And we had emphasised it would be done in a deficit-neutral way. We would strive to do it in a deficit-neutral way. The last slide, 27, is a conclusion. Pulls together what I've said, but I don't want to start enjoying hearing myself, because it's the conclusion of the details that I've presented. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks Minister and DG for the presentation, and Deputy Minister, you're most welcome as well. And members, as I indicated, we welcome the presentation for engagement as Finance and Appropriation Committees. And obviously, you'll urge members to be much more pointed, brief, so that we spread participation across. I see the first hand here, the second hand, third, and the fourth. That's the first chunk. I'll come 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. First hand, the second hand, the mat dropper. Yes. Honorable Minister.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll be brief. Hopefully there'll be a second round to ask some questions.
Yes.
So let me ask three brief questions in the first round. The first question with respect, Minister, is in relation to the economic growth forecasts. In the next financial year, National Treasury predicts that there will be 1.3% worth of GDP growth. But the World Bank predicts forecasts 1.1%, our own Reserve Bank forecasts 1.1%, and the IMF forecasts 0.8%. It speaks to the credibility of National Treasury's growth forecast and the credibility of the budget. Now, given those figures, why is the National Treasury right and the World Bank, the South African Reserve Bank, and the IMF wrong? That's the first question. The second question is in respect of economic policy. Now, in main budget 2016, government's economic policy was inclusive growth. That's if you listened to your speech in the medium-term budget policy statement in 2016. If you listen to President Jacob Zuma's State of the Nation address, government's economic policy was now radical economic transformation. Again, if one listened carefully to your speech yesterday, government's economic policy is now transformation for growth. At the end of the day, I put it to you that there's now confusion about what exactly government's economic policy is. And ultimately, that must lead to further policy uncertainty, which ultimately must erode investment and growth in South Africa. So in short, what exactly is South Africa's economic policy? Is it inclusive growth? Is it radical economic transformation? Or is it the new blend transformation for growth? That's the second question. The third question is in relation to tax and spend. Given your tax proposals, I mean, we will raise approximately 4.4 billion rand from the new super tax bracket which you announced yesterday. Fair enough. But equally, if we reduce the size of the executive from, 74 ministers down to about 15 or 16 departments, we could probably save, on our calculation, about 4.7 billion rand, which raises the whole point about the composition and efficiency of spending. And so I ask you whether you think it's not time to consider implementing a full root and branch comprehensive spending review so that we can review the composition, efficiency of spending and future spending priorities across all three spheres of government in the medium term between 17-18 and 19-20. Is it not time to actually consider a new approach, a comprehensive spending review, as opposed to the more fragmented fiscal arsenal at your disposal? Thank you.
The second, and Honourable Mantlop.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. I want to check here. What sort of leadership is National Treasury providing in the financial sector to prevent the unfortunate financial crimes and collusions by banks? For instance, those 17 banks that have been said that they have been manipulating the South African currency for their own benefit. Secondly, Chair, is around the issue of the deficit and the servicing of deficit. I want to check here. In 2016 budget, there was a promise that there was going to be stabilization around the issue of the debt at 46.2% of the GDP in 2017-18. However, the national debt is currently standing at 50.7%. What is the cause for that? Or also, can I check whether is there a debt limit or the ceiling that has been set by Treasury around the issue of the debt? Or we have a break approach because we're told that it is going to be stabilized to 46.2%, but now it's sitting at 50.7%. So I want to check whether is there any. The last one, Chair, is around the issue of the contingency reserves. I want to know how are contingency reserves planned and allocated? Is there a policy guiding it? Thanks, Chair.
Thanks very much. The third speaker, yes, Honourable Member.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to both ministers. And
just the name so that it's easier for reference.
In Kamala.
Yes, well.
Abatu Mazamba. Elfley.
Zubani.
Mazamba.
Mazamba. Okay, thanks, Honourable Mazamba.
Mr. Chairman, let me just say thank you to the finance team. For the presentation and for all the effort they put in year after year. My first comment come question would be this DG, you've quite rightly pointed out that the 12 billion is going to come out of personal income tax and it's across the board. It's not necessarily the just from the higher bracket. So that was going to be a point I was going to make, but you've made it for me. But the question of the additional tax bracket bringing in 4.4 million, how much have you factored into that 4.4 billion the possibility of people restructuring in order to avoid it? Not evade it, to avoid it. In other words, if nothing changed, would it be 10 billion? And then you've said, okay, people will try and manipulate things, and therefore we can rely on 4.4 billion. Then the question of, you made a reference to VAT on fuel. I wonder if you could elaborate on that and whether that is a possibility or not. The SVDP, it's been running now, I think, since October. You say it's brought in, well, there have been declarations of 3.8 billion, and you're now estimating income at 600 million. To me, that sounds quite low, given what we were hearing. I mean, it was just through the airwaves. There was nothing to base it on. It was just when people were giving submissions, how many billions and billions of rands there were secreted abroad. Are we hopeful that there's going to be more significant income rather than the 600 million? Now, I'm pleased that the Deputy Minister has arrived, because my annual is now coming up. Minister, in your speech, you talked about putting the additional capital into SOEs and the SG, I think, SGDG, has mentioned that, I can't remember which of you said that it was a budget deficit, and you said so in your speech as well. So are we looking then at what we were thinking about, and we mentioned earlier this week, a possible sale, for instance, of Telkom shares to achieve that, as we did with Eskom and the Vodacom shares, because our estimate is there's 14 billion sitting there available. And if so, how could we realize that kind of revenue without flooding the market with shares? My last one, again with SAA, you say that 3.5 billion of the 4.7 billion has now been used up, the additional 4.7. So that leaves 1.2 billion, as you say in your speech. But that's got to now carry them, in terms of a going concern certification that they got, until September, because your going concern lasts 12 months. 1.2 billion going to keep them going now until the end of September, or are we looking at this recapitalization program having to be fairly swift? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks. The fourth figure, yes.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Minister. Just to commend you and the team for your budget under very difficult economic and political conditions, and we see the rand is below the dollar today, so that says something. Would you say, as other economists have said, that you've done enough to satisfy the sovereign agencies that will be re-looking at our credit rating later in the year? And in the light of that, one of the main issues which they highlighted was the SOEs that have been referred to by previous speakers, and in which you on page 91 indicate that guarantees to some state-owned companies remain a major risk to the fiscus. Now, in the light of that, would you comment on some of the findings in the Public Protector's report, which have some severe indictments, and as we know, they are binding, subject to review, as well as some of the aspects raised in the Denton's report relating to Eskom, which to me are a great concern. Bearing in mind that National Treasury did look into some of the coal contracts, and we see now that some of the transport costs were way in excess of the cost of the coal. That's the one issue relating to that. And we do appreciate that Parliament has a very significant role of oversight in that regard, but the whole issue of state capture is a massive concern to us. Then the SAA, there was allusion last year to the SAA-SA Express merger in your speech. Would you give us details about that? And I didn't quite understand the capital injection proposed being deficit neutral. If you could unpack that, DG, because either, so then one presumes it's not a guarantee, but where will those funds come from? And would it then be the consideration of the sale of some non-strategic assets as was done previously? Then thirdly, just briefly, the revenue projection we know came in a lot lower than was projected last year, the 30-odd billion. And we know that your economic growth rate is projected at 1.3%, which is slightly higher than other projections. And we also know that on page 8 of your document, where you indicate there's heightened uncertainty regarding the path of revenue collection, to what degree, and clearly it's a half glass half full, glass half empty, but, and one is dealing with variables, is there not the possibility that one could sit again with the situation at the end of the year with revenue projections coming in a lot lower than you forecast? And lastly, Minister, you may not wish to answer this, but your relationship with the SARS Commissioner and relationship between National Treasury and SARS, to what degree is that impacting on the efficiency of revenue collection, given that there are a number of senior staff in revenue that have left for various reasons? Thank you for that, Chairperson.
Thanks, Honourable Swart. The hands now is Honourable Floyd, and then Sheikh Dengwa, and then Honourable Member will be the fourth. Okay, let's agree that this constitutes first round. You comfortable can start responding to this. Yeah. Okay, that will be the first, just to allow me to say if there are issues. Can we proceed then?
Thank you.
Honourable Floyd.
Thank you, Chairperson. No, our concern is the decreasing rate of corporate income tax as a proportion of the revenue that you collect. The National Treasury, of course, would suggest that it's now at 17%. I think it has been declining over the last 5 years, that as a proportion of the entire revenue collected, corporate income tax is drastically declining, meaning that the main two pillars of South Africa's revenue is personal income tax and the value-added tax, which means that it's ordinary people who are financing South Africa's state, and the companies that make huge profits are not contributing as much as they could in terms of what is required. And that is our concern. And we think that part of that decline, Minister, could be what I've always raised, that the issue of aggressive tax planning by most of these corporations. Isn't it the time that instead of the piecemeal introduction of mechanisms to deal with aggressive tax planning, we should then introduce a comprehensive legislation that will combat and criminalize aggressive tax planning, which will clarify what is avoidance, what is evasion as well in terms of tax practices. Because a substantial component of what is avoidance in South Africa borders on evasion, and that might need a legislative clarification, which I think should be one of the priority focus areas in terms of what should happen. 2 days ago, we together with the chairperson of the Standing Committee on Finance attended a seminar which was looking into the role of legislators on combating illicit financial flows. And lots of issues come out there that many countries that have even just implemented some of the few components begin to make progress in practical, tangible terms of collecting additional revenue better from all of those things. We welcome the commitment on that multinational companies are going to be now forced to country-by-country reporting. It's but one of the mechanisms to deal with tax avoidance. But I think that we must look into a comprehensive legislation that deals with this entirely so that there is adequate revenue collected to deal with all the issues that are required to be dealt with. And on transformation, I don't hear what National Treasury is saying in terms of transformation. It's like what was apparently said when we left the State of Nation Address. I don't know what was said in the State of Nation Address. Apparently there was lots of talk and rhetoric around radical economic transformation. But nothing concrete is being said of what exactly should happen with regards to the transformation agenda, because perhaps we must look back in terms of what were attempts in the economic transformation agenda in South Africa. It was an introduction of some charters of, which were agreed between business, labor, and government that let's agree on these charters. And all of them have dismally failed. Isn't it time now to legislate some of the transformation commitments with consequences for those that do not comply? I mean, the 30% that you're talking about, for instance, in terms of 30% black ownership, I thought that is what you meant. 30% black ownership on huge corporations that are going to supply the state or engage in tenders must be black representative. That must be legislated if that is your commitment. Would put a far much higher figure, as the EFF would much possibly propose, that at least a minimum of 50% of all companies that supply the state at all levels and state-owned companies must be owned and controlled by historically disadvantaged individuals. But that must be legislated. It must not just be a policy articulation that does not have any legal meaning, any legislative meaning. There are so many other sectors that they must look into, the banking sector in terms of ownership, the insurance sector, the audit firms, a variety of sectors. We should legislate transformation commitments. Because if apartheid and colonialism were legislated to segregate our people, to exclude our people economically, the only other way to include them economically is to legislate them into economic participation. There is no willful participation that is going to happen, by the way. There's not going to be willful adherence to transformation charters. And the past 23, 22 years have illustrated vividly that with the transformation charters that have existed, virtually all industries have not included meaningful black participation. They just change faces and put this one there, so we'll be compliant, and then after a term, they change to another B group without meaningful participation. I think that is one of the trajectories that you must look into in terms of how you deal with these issues. Lastly, is that you said in 2016 that you're going to introduce a tire levy to finance recycling, and you're going to increase the incandescent loop tax, the plastic levy, and the motor vehicle emissions tax, and everything else. I've not seen the update of how much money did you raise with regards to all of those aspects that you made commitment on in the 2016 budget, so that we're able to keep track of all the issues that we make commitments on. Thanks.
Thank you. Honorable Member, you missed really the opportunity to debate some of the issues in the State of the Nation. Your views would be engaged quite rigorous. Thanks.
We don't participate in illegal gatherings. We don't participate in illegal gatherings.
Comrade, Honorable Sheikh, thank you, Chair. Minister, Deputy Minister, let me welcome your pro-poor budget. However, I have some concerns. One of which is, I know a lot of resources are now being put into infrastructure programs. But I think we're all aware that in the Eastern Cape specifically, there has been underspending repeatedly in terms of the mud schools, sanitation, water, electricity. Could you perhaps tell us how are we going to correct this and ensure that the allocations are used correctly and timeously to benefit the poorest of the poor? Minister, the other concern I have is we talk about over 80,000 jobs being lost in the manufacturing and mining industry. And I think this matter was addressed before in terms of the industries that are closing, like in the manufacturing, the leather, the textile, the plastic industry. Now the poultry industry is being affected. And I know the President has alluded to increasing import duty on some of this to try and restrict imports. But the question is that enough, or do you believe, Minister, that more drastic steps need to be taken in order to create more jobs? For instance, should we not restrict the import in mass of certain products that is affecting job creation in South Africa, or actually resulting in industries closing down? The other one is the issue, I think we have now picked up on the issue of the banks colluding. But Minister, there's a bigger picture out there. There's a greater problem out there, whether it's in the motor vehicle industry, whether it's in the retail supermarket industry. There's a lot of collusion that is going on, which is affecting the poorest of the poor and how they control prices and things. So I don't know if there is a plan to actually look at that at some stage. The issue of the, must be welcomed, of the 30% to subcontractors on contracts of 30 million or more. However, Minister, my concern is, it is common knowledge a lot of these big businesses are using small businesses as just fronts and enjoying the real benefits of this. What measures are we going to put in place to try and actually stop that? And finally, we've said in the last budget as well, the issue was cost containment was a problem, irregular expenditure was a problem, but we find that it has increased. So obviously I think the mechanisms we are putting in place are not sufficient. Could you please tell us what could we do next to try and cut down on this, especially fraud, corruption, maladministration, and not getting value for money, which seems to be a problem, starting right from the lower level of municipality right to the top. Thank you, I'll stop.
Honorable Tengwa.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, Co-Chairs, Minister, and the Finance Delegation. Chair, I'll try to be very, very brief. Honorable Minister, you spoke about the additional 5 billion rands into higher education. And, of course, that would be a welcome move in light of the ongoing fees must fall challenges. But Minister, one of the things is that we may end up finding ourselves throwing financial solutions to non-financial problems. And the education is combined receiving about 21% of the allocation, this budget. Now, and the issue is it money that's needed or the capacity that is needed in school so that, you know, because you are now losing in a 12-year cycle of education about 800,000 learners in the system and only about 200,000 in the main actually make it. And a lot of emphasis is being placed on student on infrastructure, which is good. But are we actually producing, the money we're pumping in, is it producing the type of learner who's ready for university or higher education training? Because there does seem to be a gap between the two. So we keep pumping money into education, but the impact is not felt. And I think that is something that needs to be looked at. Because in the final analysis, if a student receives NSFAS funding and fails, that becomes wasteful expenditure and will probably apply again. And so I just feel that, that is something which must be looked at. Secondly, Minister, you have increased the social grants. What is the take of Treasury on this CPS SASSA problem, which on the 1st of April is obviously we know that the whole deal was unconstitutional and so on. You've made proposals about the Post Bank being one of the dispensers of these funds, but I feel that you can't be allocating resources in the manner that you are to an illegal system. It's just a matter of principle, and I feel that Treasury must make a more forceful attempt at rescuing the situation as things stand. Finally, Chair, municipalities will receive an allocation of about 9.1 of the... Now, there's always the argument that municipalities are closest to the people, all development is local. And I know, Minister, in your previous life at COCTA, you had instituted back to basics to ensure the viability and functionality of municipalities. But what else needs to be done to ensure that municipalities are able to generate the necessary income that they need in identifying economic niche opportunities in order for them to be sustainable? Because the allocation that they are receiving for all intents and purposes is quite small, to say the least.
Now, we have to then find ways and means at topping that up. And as if things continue this way, we'll end up rendering municipalities, particularly those who are in rural communities or semi-urban and so on, fundamentally useless. So we do need a financial intervention at ensuring that those municipalities are actually sustainable. I say this, of course, noting what you've said, that you know the four-point plan, or which you highlighted yesterday with regards to municipalities, but the financial health remains one of the key critical areas if we want to see viable municipalities. Thanks.
Thanks, Honourable Member. Yes, Honourable Member, can you proceed?
Thank you. Honourable Minister, the dividend tax, the increase of 33% is understandable in view of what the DG calls horizontal equity. So it's to stop high-income earners from changing their salary structure. I'm concerned with the unintended consequences. You know, specifically other people that rely on dividends that aren't in the high-income group. One group would, for instance, be all the empowerment deals that are done that rely on these dividend flows to finance the deal, past deals, and, of course, future deals. And the second group would be a group of pensioners that aren't receiving money via pensions, maybe via the unit trust, etc. Should we not maybe consider some form of an exemption for certain classes of people or create a two-tier system of dividend tax, because it is a personal tax, just to maybe soften the blow to these other groups? The bursaries, the advancement in the bursary scheme, I think it's one of the most important areas of the new budget. And the ongoing or opportunity that this can assist the government for business to play a role in reducing the cost of education. So I urge that this be communicated, because very few companies actually make use of this opportunity. So maybe from Treasury or SARS's point of view, we should actually remind people of this specific allocation. Then another area I'm concerned about is the unfunded mandates. Effectively, for instance, the primary healthcare and ambulance services, which local government is expected to do on behalf of the provinces, etc. And this comes at a much higher price than what they get into the operational grants. We need to consider how National Treasury can get this balance right, because it's life-threatening. And what's happening is the local governments are not fulfilling this mandate properly. And then the last thing I'd like to raise, also linked to local government and also to the national government, is the cost of debt is growing. It's going to continue to grow by all accounts as we have growing deficits, etc. But the local governments also affected by the same. And is there not an opportunity for National Treasury to step in and say, let's look at the debt of local governments and find a way to pool it in some way to reduce the cost of lending for all concerned, because the ability to service the capital projects is in danger in many of the larger metros and even in the smaller towns. And I think National Treasury might need to take a lead in finding a solution to reduce the cost of debt in South Africa.
Thank you. Honorable Tobias.
Thank you, Chair. Let me say to the Minister up front, I'm not going to create problems today. For simple reasons, I'm saying I must assure the Minister that I'm not going to create problems today, because I'm a little bit incoherent. Something personal happened to me. My son has got hurt somewhere. So I'll be very short with the questions I will ask. But let me say this in advance, Minister. The dichotomy between growth and redistribution is breaking even. For the first time, having read Gear a few years ago and looking at the current conjuncture, I realized that we're faced with the same situation. So I envy anybody the world over who will be a Minister of Finance having to deal with low growth and distribution. It's a very interesting phenomenon. All these competing demands at the same time. So, and if you look at the projections made by the International Monetary Fund of the world growth at 3%, and you look at our transition from 0.5% to 1.3%, you put us at one third share, and we're not saying anything. I didn't hear us saying well done to National Treasury to be able to get one third of the total world growth projection. So we're not saying a lot, and I think we should be saying that. We shouldn't be shy to say, out of only that projection of 3%, our performance is 1.3 from 0.5%. Now, then you look at the competing demands that are on the table. You look at just what agriculture is going to need. When I looked at the minister's speech, we're going to need over 30 billion, and we're only going to be able to raise 28 billion in taxes. And there's this specific sector that needs 30, it means there's going to be a shortfall of 2 billion, but only for that specific sector. And we go all over about debt service costs and all other things, but you're not speaking to it. And I'm going to raise your attention to something that was discussed in the public discourse, Honorable Minister. When I read some of, I don't want to promote who was raising these views, but that's one view I picked up. People were engaging fiercely on the investment incentives that you are providing. There was a strong argument that has been raised that we need to review the allocation of investment incentives. I'm not picking any sides on that matter. I'm just bringing it to our attention to look at maybe how can we, through the very same incentives, encourage investment, especially to the sectors that we believe will make bigger changes in the economy. We just made a bigger budget allocation again to education. But to me, it's the conversations that we're going to have with the private sector of their own initiatives in helping us to realize, because in fairness, if we're going to collect 28 billion and we need to allocate to all these competing disciplines, and we're already having a shortfall, and we're having a debt that's at 2 trillion, and the total that we'll have will not speak to that, it means we need to create friends. It means we need to have people who will say to us, look, this is the amount of money, and I'm loving you, Minister, to speak to business to say, how much can you put on the table? Because we can train the skills, we give it to you, and that skills is going to be of best interest to you and the economy in general. So those conversations should start to come up. And then the second one is the issue of the wage bill. It's a very sensitive matter when you engage the workers, because they always want to see it growing. But at the same time, it takes to the fiscals a bigger portion of, and we're too shy to speak to it, but it's an issue that we can look at. The other issue is when you're speaking about 120 job opportunities, those are job opportunities, right, that we're projecting. We want the business to say, we can contribute this much in relation to that, to ensure that we realize the total job opportunities that we believe we can create. So, like I said, that today I don't want to create problems, Chair. I want to stick to those issues. And on the CIT, it's an issue that you can deal with at a later stage in terms of long term. But the short term revenue generation has been addressed in terms of the policy statement that has been tabled so far. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Honorable Member. Let's allow the Minister to respond to the first round, and there are members that indicate, have indicated that they would like to deal with some issues. But let's allow the first round, really. The entire 35 minutes was for members to raise questions. Thanks.
Let me first prepare my colleagues for issues that they are going to handle. Shall I just cover what I can, then you guys take on whatever you can? Okay. On the question of forecasts and credibility, I should leave it to the economists to explain. But forecasts, by definition, are forecasts. Nobody that I am aware of actually comes out with the exactly same results from a forecast. So the variations that you see between the IMF or SAB and ourselves is something that you've seen, in fact, for the last couple of years. And we tend to be a little bit optimistic, but often we're not off the mark because we have the opportunity to adjust our forecast twice a year and take into account whatever new factors are at play. And we are living in a very volatile environment. So depending on which institution undertakes its forecasting exercise when, those factors have to be taken into account. So at stage A, you know, in the past, oil might have been at $75. Stage B, it might have been at $30. Stage 3, it might be at $45. So all of those begin to materially impact upon forecasts. So I don't think the credibility issue is an issue with respect. What is at issue, and often in the public discourse these days, macroeconomists are getting quite a bit of stick for not being able to either get forecasts right or to be able to point to what would solve the growth problem around the world. And perhaps that's unfair because many of the growth issues are not just so-called pure econometrics issues, they're wider issues. They involve politics, sociology, demography, and all sorts of issues that need to be taken into account. So Mr. Mania can rest assured that we'll do the best we can, but the key thing is that we're transparent about what we do. The assumptions are very transparent. If you want any more information about how Treasury approaches these issues, we can certainly provide that information. On economic policy, I think what we are trying to do is to show in the phrase transformation with growth that our challenges are a combined challenge, that we have a particular history of marginalization. Several of you have actually pointed that out. Secondly, we've reached a point of intolerance for the various levels of distress that large percentages of our population suffers at this point in time, which we said right at the beginning. And therefore, both growth, inclusivity, and transformation need to be creatively combined in our kind of situation. So if you like, both in response to yourself and Honorable Shivambu, what we are saying is that our current circumstances demand that we all contribute to elaborating upon how do we combine these three elements. I think there's general consensus now, certainly from the beginning of this year, in a much wider sense than before, as I said earlier on, that GDP numbers per se don't mean much to much of the population. Secondly, as I said earlier on, the distribution of the benefits of growth is the big issue, and that's where inclusivity becomes the new focus area. In our context, but in other contexts, the word transformation means different things. The more developed economies are concerned about technology, joblessness, training and retraining of people, and the possible eventuality, as I hinted earlier on, that they won't have, inverted commas, jobs available for their population as they go forward. And you can see parts of that already beginning to happen in the Midwest of the United States. And it will begin to happen in other economies as well. So the big conversation, for example, in October last year in Washington was, who has the best training and retraining system in the world? And how do you go about training a 45 and 50-year-old who has worked in a particular job for 20 years, now needs to switch? And I think those are the practical issues that are indicated to us that we need to take account of. On the question of number of, it's actually 34 ministers, Mr. Mania, and a lot of deputy ministers as well, so it might give you that number of 70. But let me invite you through your committee to send your recommendations to the President, because he decides on the number of cabinet ministers and deputy ministers. So I leave it to your various chairpersons to guide you in that regard. We are in no position to make any calls on this. Your thoughts on a comprehensive spending review? We have elements of that in the evaluation process undertaken by DPME and some of the spending reviews that we have actually done, and we'll look into the wisdom of what is the British practice and its relevance for South Africa, and come back to you at some stage on that. Leadership in the financial sector, Honorable Matopa, we are responsible for creating the broader framework for the financial sector, and that's why I made reference to the changes that we made following the Great Recession, in line with the G20 pattern as well, which resulted in this Twin Peaks model, prudential regulation in the SARB and market conduct regulation in a new institution. And it's going to take us a bit of time to make sure that those institutions begin to work, and it will be up to those institutions on a non-partisan basis to make sure that the appropriate disciplines actually apply. But when it comes to the trading saga that the Competition Commission has been investigating, I think we must be careful about imagining that we can intervene in anything in an intrusive way and dictate how people behave. A lot of this depends upon sometimes, if you like, the genetics of particular industries, like the financial industry, and the kind of leadership that is offered in these institutions, the risk management mechanisms that they have in place. And in our current architecture, as far as banks are concerned, it's the banking regulator residing in the Reserve Bank that has the primary responsibility for supervisory activity. But the one lesson we know from crises all over the world over the last 100 years is that however much your regulatory framework is developed, you can't avoid these sorts of issues. The key is detect them as quickly as possible, penalize the people that are actually involved, and use the possibilities of detection and heavy penalties as a disincentive to engage in this activity. But we must be aware of the countervailing forces as well in a capitalist society, that greed is a key driver. You make a little bit of money, you want to make more money, and you want to keep adding zeros at the end of the money that you make. And so the way in which incentive structures are developed and the way bonuses are paid is something that maybe as a committee you must go into. Call these institutions and ask them what are their practices. And you, like other parliaments elsewhere in the world, can inquire into that. Just as an aside, the Financial Stability Board, which was established by the G20, I think in about 2011, is coincidentally meeting in Cape Town next week, Chairperson. Mark Carney, who's the governor of the Bank of England, chairs the Financial Stability Board. So all of its members from around the world, or the G20 countries, will be at your doorstep, so to speak, and you might want to interact with them and have the benefit of their wisdom on this particular matter as well. So if you think you would like to do that, let us know. We'll see what arrangements we can make for you to interact with them. The debt limit, the DG will handle that in a moment. The contingency amount, the DG will also handle and tell you what the rules of the game are. The temptation to engage in restructuring or tax planning or tax avoidance or tax evasion, because PIT has gone up by 4%. On the one hand, I'm told that the additional avoidance temptation has been taken into account. On the other hand, where you have an effective tax administration, it must have the capacity to detect these schemes, anticipate some of these human responses that you're going to get, and at the same time, across parties in Parliament, we should be calling on our society not to engage in aggressive avoidance, because this is part of social solidarity and strengthening of the redistributive mechanism that we have through the taxation system that we should be supportive of. But I understand where Mr. Lees is coming from, that this temptation, if you like, will be there, and the tax planning industry will be quite busy making fees out of this. But again, as Parliament, you should call the tax planners of South Africa and ask them, how do they contribute to better tax morality in this country? And how do they walk the tightrope between, as Mr. Shivambu said, avoidance and evasion? In fact, the nomenclature or terminology in this regard is in serious need of change. Tax planning and tax evasion are the two, if you like, zones that we should operate in. This business of avoidance creates a lot of confusion because it's either aggressive or it's not aggressive and so on. So tax planning in the context of what the law allows it should be acceptable. The rest must be considered to be tax evasion and dealt with accordingly as well. Now, we've criminalized various forms of tax evasion over the years, particularly those who collect VAT and PAYE and don't pay it over, and there are other rules of the game. But if I can overlap your question with Mr. Shivambu's question, many of these are operating in a gray zone, and so they're either subjects of negotiations in the tax administration, or they end up in court, either tax courts or high courts or other courts of this country. And their rulings then, if you like, demarcate the territory in a particular way. The VAT on fuel, the DG will deal with. The VDP and whether we will collect more money, Mr. Tomasek is here, he can tell you what their experience is. On SAA, the DG can add to the detail, but essentially we will be looking into various options for raising money. And when we say fiscally neutral, we mean it's not going to come from within the fiscus necessarily, or nor are we going to break the expenditure ceiling to support SAA. We'll have to find other mechanisms. So once we've overcome our exhaustion, we'll apply our minds to where the money is to come from and take the public and yourselves into confidence. But as we indicated in the speech, it will happen as soon as we can resolve some of these issues. Have we done enough in respect of ratings agencies? Well, we've done enough to be a credible fiscus for ourselves, for a start. You might be interested that Treasury officials immediately after the budget, in fact, within the first 24 hours, interact with all three of the major ratings agencies and give clarity to them on what might not be clear in the books and literature that we have published. At this point in time, they seem to have enough information to provide, if you like, sufficient reassurance. The SOEs, Mr. Swart, and what you raised in respect of the public protector and the Denton report, again, Parliament should be a lot more active, if I may say so, with respect, in holding these institutions to account. I don't think you can just leave it to the Treasury all the time to be the front runner. We have lots of other work to do. But these are serious issues of corporate governance. These are serious issues about credible financial management and possible manipulation of finances in these institutions. And Parliament should take this seriously and give it the attention that it actually deserves, as should other agencies as well. And of course, you know, we have all sorts of narratives in the country to distract all of us from the facts at play. And hopefully you're not going to be distracted and watch the ball carefully in this particular regard as well. SAA and SAA Express, there's a process underway, which again is subject to a discrediting exercise through fake Twitter accounts and so on. as well. But where the process is that there's a consultant being appointed. They're looking into the feasibility of merging SAA and SAA Express. They're not there to undertake the mechanics of that. They will give us a report on whether it is feasible to do so and whether from a business efficiency point of view, it's wise to move in that direction. And once that report is available, government will apply its mind to this issue. On the revenue side and the tax administration, we've met them more recently on quite a regular basis, and we are having some very serious engagements on the whole issue, of, as you pointed out, the sort of skills, capability, and stability within the institution. We're going to have a few more meetings in the next few weeks, and hopefully we can come back to you as well. But the one thing we must not do is to personalize this. This is not between this chap called Gordon and Moyane. I don't know Moyane from anything. Right? What I'm interested in is the head of a very important fiscal institution and his management team, and whether they're doing what they're supposed to do. And, tomorrow there can be another person here in this post. But the fiscal institution, like a revenue administration, must still do its work and do so in a manner in which they actually support the fiscal objectives that our government sets out in budget processes. So be careful not to personalize this. I'm only doing my job, and hopefully they begin to do their job as well. In respect of Mr. Shivambu's question, the Deputy Minister will handle some of these, and if need be, I'll come in again on that. Mr. Sheikh, infrastructure underspending, Mr. Makajane will answer that question. We note your point about loss of jobs and the tendency to collude and the fronting exercise. And Minister Davies has taken some measures in that regard as well. On the question of irregular expenditure, again, that's not Treasury's job. It is partly to ensure that financial management systems are in place. But what happens as finances are actually managed in departments and entities is Parliament's job, because that's part of the accountability that departments and entities owe you, and SCOPA in particular. So with respect, I'm going to play rugby and pass the ball on to you, if you don't mind. Honourable Schlengauer's points around education is extremely well taken, and that's a part of our national dilemma, is it not? Spending a lot of money, and our entire education value chain is not working as it should, from early childhood education, primary, secondary, tertiary training, etc. It has all the elements there, but it needs to work as a smooth machine, and there are various issues that all of us have raised from time to time. And certainly one would agree that money is not the sole issue. And the same applies to many other instances in government as well. People think that if you throw more money at a problem, you solve the problem. That isn't the case. And we said so yesterday as well. But we certainly require better outcomes, more skilled and more capable young people going into the university system, for example, less dropouts in that system, both at secondary school and at university and training level. And you're absolutely right that we might be spending a lot of money and getting inadequate results ultimately if the same patterns of people exiting the system continues, and if the level of preparation within the education system is not what the next stage in the education system actually requires. On social grants and CPS and SASA, the Director General was approached in early December by the Social Development Department and SASA for assistance. He assembled a team which included the Reserve Bank, which controls the payment system, representatives of the Treasury and the other two institutions. They met quite intensely during that period, came up with about, what, 4 or 5 options in terms of what could be done. Those options were communicated to the Minister of Social Development. But as she pointed out to me in a letter recently, she is the ultimate executive authority on this matter. We respect that. And if you want any further information, may I refer you to her. As far as municipalities are concerned, there's some interesting graphs that the DG showed you earlier on, which show that there's a huge bias as far as the spending of the 9% is concerned towards rural municipalities. But my own view is that we might have to look at some of those issues anew. But at the same time, municipal management teams and politicians need to come to the party as well. They need to encourage better compliance amongst their citizens. They have to tackle the issue of illegal connections. They have to make sure they don't buy expensive cars and then yet are unable to pay the Water Trading Authority or Eskom at the end of the day. They need to make sure that the tenders they issue for infrastructure projects are priced properly and that the value for money is actually derived. I don't think we have an estimate yet of leakage in that system, which leakage, if it is even half stopped, what kind of resources would it provide in addition to what they actually have? And remember that our system is still based on our colonial past, because the expectation is that municipalities raise their own revenue and that nationally collected revenue makes only a small contribution to municipal finances. Now, that works in the bigger cities and towns and municipalities, doesn't quite work in some of the very small rural municipalities. But that's why we have the equitable share distributed in that way and compensation for the free basic services we offer as well. The DG might want to add something to that from his experience as well. Mr. Tomasek, dividend tax, or Chris, and the possible impact of our increases. And I'll support that if there's any need to. The point you make about communicating the dispensation that we've offered in respect of businesses offering bursaries is a valuable one. And between the Treasury and SARS, they should pick that up and make that more popular. Unfunded mandates is part of a perpetual conversation in South Africa. So I don't think we have immediate solutions to that, but it's something that we need to look at over time. Pooling of debt at a municipal level, the DG will come in on that. And Honorable Tobias makes various valuable points about competing demands, attempting redistribution and distribution within a low-growth environment. Are all formidable challenges that we face. There is a current review underway on investment incentives, and some of those incentives have been in place for a long time, either as tax allowances or active expenditure, and we need to evaluate, as you correctly point out, whether those incentives are being properly targeted. The allocations to education and business contribution, the DM can look at that if need be as well. So, Chair, if you don't mind, can I hand over and they can add?
Thank you very much, Chair. Probably I'll just focus on the issues raised by Honorable Chivambo. I think the first was around corporate tax, partly has been covered, but I think the differences normally reflect more economic cycles, pretty much. Of course, the points you're raising about avoidance are valid, and I think they've been captured by the minister. The second issue on the tire levy, I'll suggest that you look at page 206, I think, of the budget review. I think it's covered quite substantially. it gives a bit of detail on that. I mean, if you have each questions to raise, then you can raise them after reading that, because it will be useful. There are points that you raised around transformation, et cetera, I think we must continue with this discussion on transformation, but I think it's getting into an interesting stage, because we're beginning to deal with the real concrete choices that we need to make as a country. And I think we must drive it. The danger, though, is that, probably the minister was correct, the danger is to think that we can use legislation all the time to deal with it. It's not. I mean, if anything, the experience up to now has demonstrated to you that the limitation of legislation and enforcement that goes with it could actually itself be a restraint to grow, to actually making advances. So there is a need to begin to create really a serious consensus amongst all key stakeholders about what needs to be done, what targets are we setting for transformation, in which areas, etc., taking into cognizance the importance of growth, and because I think you can undermine that, but also taking into cognizance that this is not a short-term intervention. You need to address issues around education, training, etc., because this is not like something that you can deal with over a couple of 1 year or 2 years. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. A couple of honourable members referred to the issue of the growth projections. I'm sure my colleagues behind me will come in, Mr. Sachs specifically, to add on that. The Minister made the point, it's focus, not predictions, one, but we take a number of things into account, and we put out some of the assumptions that we make or that undergird what we ultimately project GDP is likely to grow at. A couple of things that we list in the review, which some of them, which we think place us in a good enough position to probably achieve the 1.3. We wouldn't put it out if we didn't believe in it. But at least at the same time, we are, I hope, transparent enough to indicate that there are risks to it. There are risks to it. But on the things that we know to be in a way out of the way, that or better now than previously, just take the table that I was showing with agriculture having contracted real value added, you know, last 2 years, there's a chance that agriculture will do better, and barring the qualification that I made, chances are that, will have a good crop across the board, maize and other grains and other things. So that should small as it is, that should make a difference. We cannot underestimate the impact on growth of some of the one-off events that have occurred in each one of the years previously. Whether it's a protracted strike that affects mining, strike in the auto sector, first components, then the other part, you know, those kinds of things. Once they are out of the system, they do give the economy a chance to do better than previously. As we point out, a depreciated real exchange rate should help. Commodity prices, real exchange rate, that is, commodity prices firming up, and if they stay on that, and of course these are big ifs. Now, it should be celebrated that although we interact with the SAB fairly regularly, we can publish different figures. We don't do it artificially to demonstrate that we can interact, but each institution has got people who can model, think independently, and come up with their focus. So we should celebrate instead. I mean, Micah, you want to add something to this before we proceed?
I would just say that the Parliamentary Budget Office did audit us and found that our growth forecasts were on average more accurate than both the World Bank and the IMF. And secondly, say that there's a joke in economics where they say, how do you know that a macroeconomist has a sense of humor? It's because they give you their forecast to the nearest decimal point. So I think the real worry about the growth forecast is more the medium term than whether we're at 1.1 versus 1.3. It's not a train smash. If we're at 1.1 instead of 1.3 by the end of the year, we would be broadly in line with our forecast, in my view. If we continue on a path of 0.5, or we don't reach 2% or accelerate towards 3% over time, then we will be very worried.
Directly connected to that, then, is in a sense, in other words, directly connected to the materiality or otherwise of the attainment or missing of our focus is the issue of revenue and debt accumulation or stabilization thereof. Largely, the reason we have not achieved what we published previously as the levels at which we expected debt to stabilize, that is GDP, in some years, even less so missing the revenue target, because the differences have not been so material. I mean, this year being unique in terms of the amounts. So I would say that they are connected to that. So in a way, there are some of these deviations from a path that was published previously are not deviations because there is a change in policy. Because that's usually what really matters. I mean, it does matter that you've missed a target, but have you made a policy decision different from the one you made previously, which then sees you missing the target? The answer is no in our case. In fact, on the contrary, what has been happening is that the government has made decisions that sought to take us back to the commitment that we made previously, whether it's the lowering of the expenditure ceiling, which means cuts in expenditure, and or raising of taxes. And none of those things is an easy thing, but they have been done because they are absolutely necessary. The contingency reserve, I would make maybe two what I consider to be important points about it. When you get to a particular year, there is no debate about whether it shall be there or not, because you are in that year. Come October, our system does not provide that we carry it. It's also, there's an anomaly. For as long as you run deficits, by the way, the contingency reserve does not mean necessarily that you've got money in the bank waiting to be spent. It just means that you have got this provision, at least in law, that should an unforeseen and unavoidable event occur, you can make an adjustment within an expenditure envelope. So in a particular fiscal year running, which takes me to the next point, when we make the decision, how big should it be? Or we, consider the proposal to put to cabinet and before parliament, how big should it be? We look at a number of things. One of them that has made us to be relatively comfortable in the recent past was the fact that there was no outstanding big decision like a wage negotiations. When you don't have that in the way, you kind of, a very big component of the expenditure is locked, 36%, 35%. Then it's other areas that can give rise to some. And of course that is applicable even in the future because we are in multi-year budgeting framework. If we think that there are too many things that we know are pending, because you can't pretend as if you are not aware that those things will come, you then have to do the responsible thing, which is to provide for it. And of course, the other thing a whole range of policy decisions, priorities, and so on, then we make a drawdown on it. I think that sometimes when we use the term drawdown, it's like we're drawing from a bank. It's not really, it's just on paper, by and large, this thing. The other points, I mean, on SAA, the minister has answered that fully, I think, including the issue of deficit neutral financing thereof. The local government pulling off its debt, one of the strengths of the South African intergovernmental fiscal system is the fact that each one of the three spheres, when it borrows, except perhaps the national one, it borrows for itself and on its own. What do I mean by that? In relation to local government, when local government borrows, a municipality borrows, they borrow for themselves and they borrow on their own. We don't guarantee government debt. I mean, countries in Latin America got themselves into serious trouble with guaranteeing each other, and before you realize it, something comes out of the woods and it gobbles you up. So our system is cushioned from that. Now, the argument often gets made, and it sounds valid. It is tempting to say the sovereign is the best credit, you can say, in our land, borrow at the best rates. Why don't you borrow on behalf of others? Which scares some of us a lot, because once government becomes a lender to other parts of the system, before you realize it, you don't know the head from the tail. And the system can eat itself up from so the benefits are far outweighed by the cost, by the moral hazard that would go with doing that. The ETI and other incentives, they are under review, most of them, and we will know comprehensively the question. Honourable Tobias posed is a very valid one. We need to know, are all incentives helping us achieve all of the objectives that we want to achieve? If we want to achieve growth, are they helping us do that? If we want to achieve more employment, are they helping us achieve that? Are they the best way to achieve all of those things, or are there better ways to achieve those things, and if yes, what those are? Chris, will you talk about what was the other question? VAT on fuels, I think that they are. Yeah.
Thank you, honourable members. The point on the impact on the zero rating on fuel, in the budget review, we've put this forward as a proposal to consider during the year. I think we are cognizant of the impact that this would have. It would be very similar to a large increase in the fuel levy. We've written there that because we are cognizant of the impact, we would consider freezing the fuel levy or perhaps even decreasing it to try and mitigate those impacts. We have done some analysis. We are looking at the direct costs to households of actually purchasing fuel, which would be higher, and also the indirect costs, which as it would flow through to food and the cost of transport. So we will do more technical work, and we will try and consult during the year to see what we can do for budget 2018. On the dividends tax and BEE deals, we do recognize that some deals, not all, use dividends as a mechanism to pay off the loan within the BEE structure. We don't think this will undermine the role of ownership through BEE deals, but it might lengthen the time at which those deals are structured. So they would be slightly lengthened as the dividend payout to pay off the loan is slightly lower. On the impact on pensioners, I mean, for most pensioners, they would have built, they will build up and will have built up funds within their retirement funds, and there is no dividends withholding tax in a retirement fund. But acknowledge that it's different to the interest exemption and the capital gains tax exemption in that the first rand that you earn in a dividend is taxed. Internationally, we do know that some countries have differentiated rates, and it is a lot more administratively burdensome because you basically got to set up a dual system. Given the dividends withholding tax is quite a new tax, it's obviously something we can look at from a technical perspective as options and discuss with the minister.
So just on the voluntary disclosure and the slow start, so although the window has been open since October of last year, the legislation was only promulgated on the 19th of January this year, and for the more substantial players, they want certainty, so they would tend to hold back until they have the absolute certainty they're looking for with respect to the legislation. You also have the rather South African phenomenon of waiting until the last minute. It's not quite the same thing, but if you go back to the 2003 exercise, just over half the applications came in on the last 5 days. And that's particularly impressive when you consider that two of those days were over a weekend. Back then we didn't have e-filing, so SARS had its offices open on Saturday and Sunday. I tried to park at one of those offices on the Sunday to just visit and see how things were going. I battled to get a parking bay. So just a little anecdote as to how South Africans treat this and the deadlines. The other point that I would make is that I think that as the realization that information will start flowing between tax administrations from September sinks in, there will be a lot more appetite to take up the offer that we put on the table. And I think that's an important point to note.
Thanks, Minister. Honourable Sheikh asked a question about education infrastructure, schools, in particular in the Eastern Cape, MAT schools. In what we have done, if you look at page 62 of the budget review, we have noted and recognized the challenge that we're having around slow spending, in particular in the Eastern Cape. As at December, after stepping up efforts, spending was at 66% in the Eastern Cape from a budget of 1.6 billion. But noting that challenges that we had, we then had to engage the department, and we agreed, and the details are in the Division of Revenue Bill, to merge from 18-19 onwards, to merge the education infrastructure grant and the school infrastructure grant into one. Spending over the 3 years is about 36 billion, as we have indicated yesterday in the budget speech. But it's also important that jointly with the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation, together with relevant committees in Parliament, we have to ensure that the targets that the departments have set themselves to spend, that those targets are met. The targets, as articulated in that page 62, 510 inappropriate and unsafe schools will be built by year 18-19. That is in 2 years, meaning this year and next year. About 1,120 schools will be provided with water, and 741 schools with electricity and infrastructure and sanitation, according. So I think it's important that we leave these numbers out so that when we engage on a quarterly basis, in our case in the Appropriations Committee, that when need be, that the relevant departments are called in together with the Departments of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation to ensure that these targets are met. Because one of the things that we've identified was planning and the capacity within the department, in particular in the Eastern Cape. Once we addressed and we kind of started addressing those challenges, we saw increased
spending. And I think if we all recognize that education is key and critical and infrastructure is important, we then have to actually ensure that we embark on ensuring that departments appear and appropriate questions are asked, and we will be ready and stand ready to actually engage and bring in financial data and spending data for the departments to account in front of the committee. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I heard Honorable Fick and Honorable Sithole. I'll give them their 2 minutes just to flag issues, and then the chairs for their comments. And there are serious pressures of time, and obviously it boils down to how we program immediately after the budget presentation, because as well there's a sitting of the House underway. So can I give the two members to comment?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I'll be very brief given the time constraint. Just a question to the Minister. Indicated that after the budget that the three ratings agencies are contacted. Can we just get an indication who those three ratings agencies are, given the fact that there might be another one that we learned about? Our costs, our debt costs are substantially high because obviously our debt is high. Can we just get an indication, Minister, the cost of debt, what is our cost of debt, given that some European countries are paying between 0 and 0.5%. So what is our cost of debt? The other issue which comes up, it's an age-old problem, that regarding the 30-day invoices that must be paid within 30 days, and you indicate that it will be monitored. So after the monitoring, if it continues that small businesses are not paid or businesses are not paid within 30 days, what is the consequence if businesses are not paid within 30 days? Thank you.
Thanks. Honorable Fick, Honorable Shope, Sithole.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Minister, once again. I've been very pleased with your budget, especially that you did not raise a VAT which affects rural women. So I'm very happy. But I'm just worried about, you know, the banks, this corruption of the banks. Is it possible for us to come out with a legislation that can actually make sure that there is consequence for wrongdoing? I don't mean fines. I mean actually handcuffing them and put them in jail so that we cannot have a repeat of this, because it is killing our rent. Eh? The other one is the one that worries us, me and Dr. Fixoman, the credit rating agencies. You know, I'm thinking about them a lot. I'm just saying that, is it not perhaps being unfair for them to come and govern without any elections? Because I think the voters of South Africa has voted us to run this country, not for them to come and impose their wish on us. I know you have got no power on them, but I am thinking aloud, and I'm even thinking of whether we can't report them to the ICC. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's just a minute for you, Honorable Menier, for your follow-up, and Honorable Shivambo, and then start my chairs.
Chair, I've got three questions, and I'll try and fit them into a minute.
No longer further questions, now you can comment. Okay. Crystallize your questions, something. You could be very creative than asking specific questions.
I want to ask three specific questions.
Okay, they must be short.
But they'll be short. I was just a little concerned when during the DG's presentation that he suggested that National Treasury doesn't have a fiscal target or a fiscal objective. My understanding is that National Treasury's key fiscal objective is to stabilize debt, and in the main budget 2016, that objective was to stabilize debt at 46% of GDP in 2017-18. And it appears that National Treasury have failed to achieve that objective. I wonder if you could just be clear, is that National Treasury's central fiscal target, and did National Treasury achieve that target or not? I think that's important because it relates to fiscal credibility, because what we're seeing is that the target to set, the target to achieve the stabilization of debt keeps getting pushed out and pushed out. It pushed up. And it's a bit like a slow puncture. And it seems to me that at some point that is going to dent the fiscal credibility of the National Treasury, which has been built up over many years and is still intact. The second question, just briefly, is National Treasury conduct reviews of contracts, and we know are either conducting or hopefully have completed their review of the Eskom coal contracts. Where are we with that review? Has it been completed, and is the report ready? And then finally, Minister, I have to ask this question. You'll deal with it in a way that you think appropriate. Mr. Brian Malefi has been appointed.
Well,
sworn
that's
as
not
the
question. Thanks.
Would you care to comment?
Honorable Minister, that's not the question. That one. Honorable Chibambo?
No, thanks, Chair. It looks like the ANC will be difficult to report any case to the ICC because by that time you have withdrawn, even with the court ruling. You can still do it if you go through the parliamentary process, which you can do it. But the question which I'm much more seriously want to look into is the minister says he agrees with the Davis Tax Committee on not fragmenting tax administration and tax customs administration and tax and customs collection, as is proposed by the border management agency process. Like, what is the attitude? I thought that cabinet has taken a posture that there must be a BMA which is going to be responsible for a certain component of customs. Maybe we need some certainty and clarity in terms of how that should be handled, because I thought this a cabinet posture in terms of that, and you are agreeing with the Davis Tax Committee position that says that it shouldn't be. And my view is that it shouldn't be stratified, like the customs administration and collection must not be stratified. And yeah, but want to know what then becomes the status of the BMA in that regard.
Thanks, Honorable Fred. Honorable Chair, I'm here now. Chess, can you comment?
Thank you, Chairperson. On the issue of fiscal policy and monetary policy, I firmly propose that the committees, as we gather here today, have a session called a workshop or equilibrium with the Treasury as well as the Reserve Bank as part of our program as soon as possible. Secondly, Chair, that we also invite the National Treasury to account on the financial management improvement in municipalities. We did it in ANCLP last year. Mr. Jan Hatton, he came down to address us. We can take that further. Lastly, on the issue of the banks, the implementation of the Twin Peaks legislation. Part of that refers to the banks, etc. Then lastly, Chair, that we don't forget the message of this budget. The growth challenge is intertwined with the transformation imperative. That must be in our focus. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, let's floor Honorable Fossa.
Well, thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to also add my voice to this discussion. Well, from where I am sitting, I can confidently say that from the briefing and the subsequent vigorous engagement, indeed, this budget is a balanced budget, regardless of the fact that the Minister found himself having to maneuver within a very little room, you know, or space, but it is a balanced budget. And actually, in his opening remarks, he said it was a difficult they had difficult decisions to take, you know, in forming the budget. But also, I would like to thank members for their engagement, because at the end, listening to all the arguments and the responses, the adequate responses by the department, by National Treasury, it was a useful engagement. I'm sure we can now go back and start to do our work. We're ready now. Just have got to go and work hard. But what will be key also, as we work hard, is the statement that says working together, regardless of our different political party affiliations. Now, on this budget, because it is a budget that is aimed at indeed radically transforming the economy of this country, and not for ourselves. I do want us to think about it, but for the future of our children. We can't leave this future in tatters. So it's only when we work together on budgetary issues that we will be able to push this nation to greater heights. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I don't know, it's subject to things for now, but we'll see what the committees think as a whole. But I think this relationship in growth and transformation spells out in the budget, and more elaborately in the City Press article this past Sunday, for those of you who haven't seen it, by Deputy Minister Jonas, in the context of a view, at least, of his. I'm not sure when the Treasury officially sanctioned it, but so what? The view that actually the economic... the negotiated deal of 1994 has exhausted itself. I don't think people should read that. Secondly, I think the notion of a charter of economic rights is very welcome in my view. I'm not sure what Treasury intends, but the committee itself wants to apply its mind, but Treasury officials next week and the week after will get responses. Thirdly, on SAA, we understand there are limits, but we feel very strongly, Minister, to the extent the shareholder management role warrants it or provides for it, something that we their money, and I think all four committees here and all of Parliament need to be far more decisive. The PFMA need to be applied more decisively. Parliamentary committees should look into pursuing civil servants that don't do their job or do the wrong thing. Finally, Ministry might be interested to know. The Parliamentary Budget Office last week, well, one of them at least, or maybe more than one of them, feel that, look, we can do all these balancing acts and so on, but at the end of the day, the fiscal objectives we have may be questionable. I mean, we've been focusing on reducing unemployment, poverty, creating jobs, etc., growth, and so on. But we are where we are. And if you look at the last 23 years, have we got as much as we could have got had we reviewed fundamentally some of our fiscal framework premises and objectives? They're going to come to us next Tuesday with a more elaborate explanation. Finally, as members, we also have to know, this is an initial exchange with your minister, deputy minister, and teacher. But as members, we also have to look at our last year's budget report. We also have to look at our FTPPS report, so that we don't start as if we, like, just come to Parliament this week and start it in January. We must link our previous reports. We've set some very clear recommendations. So when we build on this discussions from next Tuesday onwards, can we please... Can you please send out our last year's reports to members so that they look at it, and when we come here, we're more focused and directed, and we have clearer goals ourselves, what we as Parliament expect from Treasury. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Minister. Well, on my side, I'm not really, I just want to comment, Minister, that it should be appreciated, the announcement that you made yesterday around the Financial Sector Summit.
which should be welcomed. It's very important to deal with the very financial sector. It's my view that the challenge, especially around cartels or monopolies, is quite complex, and it requires a vigorous program to deal with, because the strength of monopoly itself is economic power. It can pay fines and revert back to the old ways of being creative and undermine developmental goals. So it's quite a need that really we engage vigorously with this one. Thanks very much, Minister. Your concluding remarks. Okay. Thanks.
On the question raised by Honorable Shivambo on BMA, look, I mean, there is a conversation going on between ourselves and the Minister of Home Affairs and the Deputy President to look into the matter. I think we hold a view that you cannot fragment the customs value chain, and that we must try as much as possible to protect the value chain and make and ensure that it remains integrated, as it were, in line with the Davis Committee's recommendation. There is also, I think, a lot of evidence globally that shows that once you start doing that, it impacts on what you collect. And customs and excise is a significant component of revenue in the country. So once you start tampering with that, you're likely to get into problems. We're trying to find either exclusion clause within the current bill or at least some accommodation of that view through one mechanism or the other. The discussion is still very early, but I think we're concretizing that hopefully in the next couple of weeks. Thank you.
If I can rush through responses to the rest of the questions. The three ratings agencies, Moody's, Fitch, and S&P. The debt costs, please look at page 87 of the budget review. The details are there because it varies depending on the length of the borrowing. On the 30-day payment, we're not the only people involved. The presidency is also involved. But I think we're weak on consequences, let's be frank, on that. But we'll get our procurement office to prepare some response for you. Honorable Shopis Tole, I understand your frustrations, but the reality is the reality. If you want to borrow money, see, the best thing is to have a balanced budget. Then you don't have to borrow from anybody. Then you don't have to worry about any ratings agencies. We're not in that position at the moment. So until we get to that position, part of our job on behalf of the country is to make sure the country gets the best possible deal. That's the page 87 numbers that I'm talking about. So I'm afraid, we don't allow them to govern South Africa. Let's be absolutely clear. They can say what they like. That's their view. And we can then decide what we want to do as South Africa. So we have both political sovereignty and fiscal sovereignty. The question is whether in the way we manage our finances and our budgets and our expenditure and our discipline, we are sacrificing our fiscal sovereignty. You see, that's the question. So often we have to look in the mirror, not look at the ratings agencies, and ask ourselves as South Africans, but also as the governing party, are we doing the right things? Even as Parliament, are we assertive enough? Are we intrusive enough? Are we holding people to account adequately? We're not. So you know, it's nice to blame somebody else out there. Let's take responsibility for our own country. As a collective, they can impose nothing on us at the moment, but if we slip on the fiscal side, they can we'll find ourselves like other African countries and countries elsewhere in the world at the doors of the IMF, and then we'll have to do their bidding. But the choice is ours. We can either defend our fiscal sovereignty or we can sacrifice it. That's the simple choice that we have. So that's one of the choices that we're talking about. Similarly, on the banks, as the Deputy Minister was saying, it's not just the banks that collude. You have business colluding. So you had collusion, I think, investigations in the cement industry, bread industry, construction industry that Minister Patel just reported upon. So it's much wider. I know this topic is an important one right now, but I gave my responses to that earlier on. Our fiscal objective, Minister Mania, but that's going to take some time. Not in your lifetime. I won't ask you your age just yet. But debt is not the fiscal target. Debt depends on all sorts of variables, depending, for example, on growth, the pace at which your economy grows. Remember, 46% or 50% can become 40% or 38% overnight, inverted commas, if the economy grows. So once the denominator changes, the proportion changes at the end of the day. And we are still considered to be very credible customers, if you want to put it that way. People will lend us money. Our bond issues are most often than not oversubscribed on a massive basis because people can make money by lending us money at the end of the day. But as Michael Sachs would say, which is his primary task in the Treasury, it's the primary balance that we're looking at. And we're getting that right, where revenue is beginning to override expenditure as a factor. And if we continue with that, we'll serve ourselves well. So there's no, I know you're looking for failure, but you ain't going to find it, regrettably. On the Eskom contracts, I'm not sure. I know the process is about to be concluded, but I can't give you a factual answer, so we'll have to come back to that. And I'm sure you will welcome any new member of Parliament, Mr. Mania. On the BMA, we've answered that question. The idea of the workshops, I think, Chair, is useful. But can I make one appeal to the NCOP? That don't take too long consulting on the Twin Peaks legislation. Because if you do your work faster, the bill will become an act. The President hopefully will sign it into law, and then we can begin to set up the institutional framework. So it's an appeal to you to look into that. And then we take your point, Mr. Karim, on SAA, and we're working hard at it. It'll be fascinating to have an engagement with the budget office. I haven't. Mr. Sachs and others might have. And if they have different ideas, we'll welcome any contribution which would make us wiser than we might be at this point in time. And once again, thank you very much to all of you.
Thanks very much, Minister and Deputy Minister, together with your team. I believe that it has been a long day having to engage with various sectors of society to articulate the budget and peg it, and also believe that our committees will engage in its program really of vigorous oversight and also conduct public hearings and really deal with this budget process as required in the money bills. Thanks, provinces, that has made it to this meeting, provincial delegations, much more useful. This was a productive session. Thanks the most. We adjourn.
Thank you, Chair.
Probably tomorrow night, but you would.
I won't be there.